From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. Over the last several weeks, a series of wildfires, some natural, others believed to be started by people, have burned more than 150,000 acres in Washoe County. The Bug, Fred Mountain Stallion, and the latest, Hawk Fires, force as many as 40,000 people to evacuate, some more than once. Dozens of homes were destroyed or otherwise rendered uninhabitable. That includes residents in the badly burned Horizon Hills neighborhood located on the north side of Peavine Mountain in Reno. KUNR's Lucia Starbuck spoke to one couple who recounted their harrowing experience while evacuating.
Sierra Dry sat in the driver's seat of her Subaru Outback trying to leave with her partner, four dogs, two cats, and a flock of chickens. Thick smoke blocked the sky as sagebrush burned alongside the one road leading in and out of the neighborhood.
I was like calling my grandmas. I don't know if I'm going to get out or not. I'm from Northern California, and so the Paradise Fire really came to mind and what it was like for people trying to leave and having flames enveloping their cars. That's all I could think of, was that my car was going to catch on fire.
Dry, who is a nurse, says she has the knack for staying calm. Her friend rode a motorcycle right next to her.
He was ready to have me hop on the back if I needed to abandon my car. And I had a chicken that was getting trampled in the crate with the other ones and wasn't doing well. And so I was holding her. And so I was like, well, I'm going to stuff this chicken in my shirt and hop on a motorcycle and hope my dogs can run behind us.
When they left their home, her partner Matt was driving his own truck, but eventually had to ditch it and hop in with Sierra. As they waited for traffic to move, they took video of the scene unfolding around them.
Oh my God. Right, yeah, do not, yeah, wait right here. Stop, stop. Go, go. Oh my God.
It took 30 minutes to reach North Virginia Street. She says she could feel the heat inside the car, which is still covered in ash and reeks of smoke. Before they left, she says their home was still in the yellow, get ready to evacuate zone on the Watch Duty app. One of the only places people can get information about the wildfire, evacuations, and road closures. She says it didn't update to a mandatory evacuation zone until Saturday evening after they had left.
We were already out of the neighborhood, and I believe we'd been out of the neighborhood for at least an hour when it finally updated to get out now.
That afternoon before they left, friends helped them water down the house and rip shrubs out from the dirt in the backyard to create a defensible space.
We had friends going through the house, trying to pull anything that maybe looked important. And my parents are both dead, so I was grabbing anything that came from them, which I don't have very much of. I have some Goosebumps books from my papa that still say, "To Sierra, love Papa," in them.
They had been couch surfing the last four nights and are back home now, but still without power. The hills behind their home are scorched, along with many of their neighbors' homes. Dry and other residents on the north side of Peavine are questioning the firefighting response here versus the wealthier Somerset neighborhood. She says there were no firefighting personnel in the neighborhood as the blaze burned toward them until they were in gridlock traffic trying to flee.
Why would they want to save these houses here for blue-collar workers when they have multi-million dollar homes on the other side?
While residents are assessing the fire's destruction, they're dealing with another challenge. Next month, planning commissioners are potentially discussing rezoning some of the plots behind Dry's home for more warehouses. She says their one road in and out just can't handle it. The couple spent Wednesday afternoon unloading stuff back into the house and caring for the animals. The day the fire started, one of her chickens hatched six chicks, and by the time they returned, one of the chickens she had to leave behind had two more.
Whoever can come up with the six best fire names gets to name the baby chickens.
So far, they've decided on two names, Hawk and Defensible Space. Lucia Starbuck, KUNR News.
With me now to talk about the overall response to these massive wildfires is Bert Johnson, KUNR senior correspondent. Bert, thanks for chatting with me.
Thanks, Paul. Happy to be here.
Bert, this series of fires burning in Washoe County over the last month, put it into perspective for me. How much of northwestern Nevada have we seen burn in recent weeks? How much damage are we talking about?
Well, like you said in the intro to the show, we're looking at more than 150,000 acres burned so far. And a lot of that is very close to the population center of Reno Sparks. So, you know, the acreage tells one story, but I think what we're starting to see and what we're going to continue to see is really kind of the long-term impacts of these fires, you know, both in terms of the recovery, as you mentioned, dozens of homes have been lost, and also there's a lot of infrastructure damage, of course, but then looking at concerns about knock-on effects to the environment, like the increased potential for landslides and mudslides when we finally get some good rain. And then perhaps even more importantly, we also have to consider the emotional impact to the community of incidents like this. You know, the Bug Fire and the Hawk Fire were only 2 weeks apart. So that's a real, it's been a tough month.
Let's talk about the response. I've seen on social media and from people talking that officials handled the two sets of evacuations for the Bug Fred Mountain Fire and the Hawk Fire very differently. So what's going on there?
Right. A big difference is the Bug Fire was further away from the population centers in North Reno. That's an area called the North Valleys. Now, some of those neighborhoods did get evacuated for both incidents, but the Hawk Fire did a lot more damage, and it got into those population centers much more quickly. Within 12 hours of the fire starting, it had already destroyed some homes, and it was moving really fast. Now, part of what happened was just a function of having to evacuate so many people so quickly. At its peak, if I remember correctly, around 90,000 residents were evacuated in a community that's less than 500,000 people in the metro area. That's a really significant portion of the population. So in some ways, the differences are just a function of where these fires were burning. At the same time, we've heard from a lot of residents in our community who say that, you know, officials just weren't as forthcoming as they would have liked them to be with information about the Hawk Fire, especially people who were evacuated as soon as they got to a safe place. Obviously, they were concerned about their friends, relatives, neighbors, and their homes, and they wanted information. Now, it's understandable to be impatient for information like that. It's also understandable that crews are not necessarily going to be able to give you updates right away because they're busy fighting the fires. But a lot of folks say that local agencies were over-reliant on social media updates and weren't as responsive as they would have liked them to be in terms of directly answering their questions.
Now, two of these blazes, the Bug Fire and the Hawk Fire, each claimed a life. Sherry Floyd died Saturday afternoon on August 15th at UC Davis Medical Center in Sacramento after suffering from severe burns and smoke inhalation. Haida Medina Valiente, 83, was transported to UC Davis Medical Center after sustaining injuries in the fire, the Hawk Fire. That was August 22nd. She passed away. What do we know about these two deaths?
Right. So in the case of Floyd, very tragic case, unfortunately, Sherry and her husband, Eddie, had been given the warning from some neighbors, is what I've been told, and were on their way out and then had to turn around. The last I heard, people weren't 100% sure why they turned around. It could have been that they were going back to try and save some more of their animals. They ran a horse rehabilitation ranch in Lassen County, just over the state line in California. People also think they may have been going back for some medication, but essentially once they turned back around, their vehicle was overtaken by the flames. And then in the case of Valiente, unfortunately, she was living in a trailer in the North Valleys with two other people, her niece and her niece's boyfriend. None of the three of them got an alert to evacuate. And so, unfortunately, the flames just got to their neighborhood before they even knew they had to get out. And none of these are young people. It seems that none of them speak English very well. Apparently, my colleague Maria Palma spoke to the son of one of the victims, and apparently he understands English but doesn't speak it himself. So there were potentially language barriers as well. But the rub is none of them got an alert on their phone. And so in both cases, what we're seeing is just this extreme fire behavior where these blazes are moving really, really fast, and it's very serious. You know, when those evacuation alerts come in, or when they do, if they do, I should say, it can be a matter of minutes. And we also heard that in the story before we started talking, of course.
Do we know why they didn't get alerts?
That is a little bit unclear, to be honest. So at this point, I've been working on some follow-up reporting about this. At this point, it seems that potentially the system that Washoe County uses to alert residents is an opt-in system. However, it's also not clear to me if there's a separate system that handles things like Amber Alerts. So for instance, I got an evacuation alert from the Hawk Fire, even though I don't live in anywhere near the evacuation zones. And that's because what Washoe County did was they signed up people whose names appear on sewer bills for their alert system. And my name is on my sewer bill. However, a lot of people who lived in the evacuation zones would have had to proactively take that step to sign up, is what I've been told. But at the same time, again, a lot of folks who didn't get evacuation alerts for this fire were still getting Amber Alerts. There was one that came last week that a lot of people in town got.
Bert, that is where we're going to have to leave it. Bert Johnson is KUNR Public Radio's senior correspondent. Bert, thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul.
Annual electricity consumption in the U.S. is expected to grow more than 55% by 2050, with the steepest growth concentrated in the current decade, according to the National Electrical Manufacturers Association. Much of that growth will fuel data centers. To meet that demand, the Trump administration recently announced plans to jumpstart a new generation of nuclear power. At the same time, Nevada Democrats in Congress have reintroduced legislation aimed at permanently ending Yucca Mountain's role as the country's sole nuclear waste repository. That includes Nevada's 1st District Congresswoman, Dina Titus. Before joining Congress, Titus researched nuclear policy as a professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I spoke to her earlier this week to get her take on the future of Yucca Mountain. Congresswoman Titus, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me. These are important topics.
Before we start talking about the future of Yucca Mountain, I first want to get your take on the push by the Trump administration to jumpstart a new age of nuclear power generation. You've spent much of your career in academics researching these sorts of policies. So are you supportive in any way of the administration's efforts here?
Well, I'm not. If you look at what's happened in the development of nuclear power in recent years, just focus on the one facility that's in Georgia that took 7 years longer than they anticipated and went way over budget. And then look at what they're proposing. Even the Department of Energy says it's not realistic. They would build more nuclear power plants in the next few years than they've built in the last 50. And they're talking about billions of dollars. And the one problem, that's what I've focused on, is that you're putting the cart before the horse. You are developing more nuclear power and you still haven't solved the waste problem.
In that vein, the administration's pushing for these nuclear innovation campuses. We've seen Utah, Idaho, other states push for them. They're also looking to ramp up uranium extraction and refinement. Do you expect any of that process to happen here in Nevada?
Well, I don't. The bill that was leaked that we got the draft of shows that they're pivoting away from Yucca Mountain, that there are actually five states that they've selected. You mentioned Utah, Tennessee, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Idaho, and they're dangling billions of dollars and promising lots of jobs to get those states to accept that. The good thing about the bill is it says we're not going to do Yucca Mountain anymore, but that doesn't mean Yucca Mountain necessarily goes away. Another thing that they're ramping up along these same lines is the use of these small modular reactors. They're talking about those to provide power for data centers, also on military bases. Now, those would be scattered all around the country. And so we're right back to the problem of temporary storage on facilities scattered everywhere.
So you, along with Representatives Horsford and Lee, have introduced the Jobs No Waste Act in the House. If I'm not mistaken, that bill is the same as the version that was introduced in the Senate by Senators Catherine Cortez Masto and Jackie Rosen. Tell me about that legislation. What would it do?
Well, it's really redundant. It's really symbolic as for our saying, yes, we support not having Yucca Mountain. You know, we've done this many times. It's not likely to pass. If they pass something, it'll be the bill that the Department of Energy and Commerce, you know, that they are pushing. But it does basically the same thing, that we're not going to reopen Yucca Mountain and we're going to look for alternatives. Now, there was a study in 2011 by the GAO, Harry Reid commissioned it, to look for alternative uses. And they came up with about 30 of things that you can now use Yucca Mountain for. One of the biggest ones, and the one that's kind of gaining traction now, is for data centers or data storage. Unfortunately, the facilities out there were built to be temporary. They're old. They haven't been kept up. They don't have good ventilation. So it's not going to just be an automatic transition to something else.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Part of the argument has always been Yucca is an unfit site geologically. Would this site need environmental mitigation? And even could you get to that level of environmental mitigation?
Well, you're right. That there are faults out there. There's the water table out there. That's the kind of that aside from the transportation to get out there. All of those reasons were reasons why this wasn't a good site. You know, they picked it and then they eliminated other possibilities, but it never was perfect. It moved from being why this is a good site to how can we make it a good site. And that's two very different kind of approaches. Now, in order to make it work for something else, you'd have to do a ventilation system. There's humidity that builds up in these tunnels. You know, that would complicate data storage, that you got to have climate controlled environments. It would be a major investment to convert it to some other use. But I mean, it is out there. It is available. It has some facilities. And so rather than just having wasted all that money all these years for something that's not going to be used, I think it makes sense to look at some of these alternatives.
And what would you like to see personally come out of Yucca?
Well, I want to be sure that it doesn't get revived. You know, any bill can be changed from one Congress to the next. Just because we're saying now we're not going to use it doesn't mean that they won't go back to it in the future, especially if they ramp up this nuclear energy program like the president is talking about doing. I'm going to keep fighting it forever. You know, you don't ever give up because you don't ever trust them to move on. But I'd like to see that not happen. I thought it'd be a good place to put a data center because of it's kind of isolated. It won't have the impact on the water and energy costs that you see it in, like out in Boulder City, where the people are so upset about it on public lands there. But, I think you've got to do a study to see just what's out there, what's left out there, and what are some realistic things.
This push by the administration comes towards the end of this particular Congress. Do you think that we'll see traction on this before the end of the year, or is this something that's going to be up for debate in Congress for the next several years?
Well, there's not much time left to do anything before the end of this session. We're there for a couple of weeks in September. We've got some finance things to deal with, keeping the government open. And then the election, we're out in October for the election. So there's really not time to do something this major. But what we're seeing is that a lot of these policies are being put in place by agencies, not going through Congress. And so it was the Department of Energy that actually leaked this information about those five sites and about opening up these campuses that you mentioned, nuclear life cycle innovation campuses. So that was done without Congress. So I think you'll see some traction on this as long as Trump's president, because follow the money. And he thinks nuclear power is a good thing to develop. Now, why in the world we would want to build more nuclear power plants when you could do solar or even wind that's much safer and less expensive? You know, I don't know, and that's what we'll be fighting. They want to quadruple nuclear energy output by 2050, and that's just not realistic.
Representative Titus, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Nearly 30 years after he was gunned down at an intersection near the Strip, a Clark County jury found Dwayne Keefe D. Davis guilty of orchestrating the killing of rapper Tupac Shakur on Monday, August 31st. After weeks of testimony, the jury deliberated for just 3 hours before convicting the 63-year-old Davis of murder with the use of a deadly weapon. He faces sentencing in October. It's the first and may potentially be the only conviction in a case that has gripped hip-hop fans for decades. Here's Clark County District Attorney Steve Wolfson speaking to reporters about the case yesterday, September 1st.
There's a saying in the criminal justice system, justice delayed is justice denied. Well, not today, not in this case. Yesterday, the jury delivered swift justice.
Covering it all is Jessica Hill. She's a Las Vegas-based reporter for the Associated Press. I spoke to her just after Wolfson concluded his comments. Jessica, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
The jury took just about 3 hours to return a guilty verdict. What was the reaction in the courtroom?
There was just a lot of, you know, silence as we were waiting, a lot of anticipation. You could tell that there was a lot of tension in the room. As soon as the verdict was read, the family of Tupac Shakur got emotional. His sister, Seth Shakur, was crying, and some family members like reached over and, you know, put their arms on her shoulder. And then they even hugged the prosecutors after the verdict and after the trial had ended. On Davis's side, his son was also there on the other side of the courtroom behind Davis, and he was also crying. So both sides, it was an emotional scene.
You know, this case has garnered a lot of international attention. What was the mood outside the courthouse?
So there were some like really dedicated fans outside who were watching this trial. One person had like taken a bus in from Denver just to sit through this trial. They expressed, you know, feeling like the sense of justice and hoping that Tupac's family had also felt this sense of justice. There was definitely a lot of excitement and like elation outside the courtroom after the verdict had been read. And then just speaking with some fans who were not able to attend the trial, they were talking about how they felt like this was like the moment that after 30 years, their favorite musician would finally see some justice and this, you know, long unsolved murder would finally come to a resolution.
Now talk to me about the prosecution's case, because it was pretty straightforward. Essentially, they relied on statements Davis made himself. Statements like what?
So basically, there were four main statements that the prosecutors relied on, two of which were police interviews, law enforcement interviews. One was a documentary interview for Death Row Chronicles. And then the fourth was his own book. And basically, Davis, the story kind of varies throughout these statements, but each one puts him inside of that Cadillac and says that he was the one that provided the gun. So there are some details that vary throughout, but what prosecutors really try to nail down that, and this goes against what his defense is that, you know, he's unreliable and not credible. The prosecutions say, yes, there are parts where he is lying and there are parts that we don't know is true, but here is what is true. And they went through, you know, each statement. He says he was in the Cadillac. He provided the gun. It was in retaliation, the beating of his nephew, Orlando Anderson. So prosecutors really just try to rely on these four statements and showing the kind of cross-throughs of what is true throughout each one.
Do we know yet if Davis plans to appeal the verdict?
So he did say, actually, and go back to your first question about what the, you know, courtroom was like, right after the verdict was read and the jurors were dismissed, Mr. Davis did stand up and say he wants his stuff back that was taken from him. And he also wants to appeal. And I don't remember exactly what Judge Kearney said, but basically like we understand. And talking with the district attorney today, District Attorney Wolfson did say it's every person's right to appeal, especially in a murder case. This is not unusual. And, you know, he'll respect the, you know, the right of the law and see that go through the appellate process.
Sentencing is scheduled for October. Do we know yet what prosecutors are asking for?
He will receive a minimum of 40 years in prison. So it's looking like it'll be life in prison. Prosecutors did dismiss the gang enhancement charge yesterday once the jurors turned in the guilty verdict regarding murder in the first degree. The jurors were taken back out of the courtroom and there was some deliberation between the attorneys in the back rooms. We don't really know exactly what was said, but they have decided to dismiss the gang enhancement part, which would have, you know, increased the sentence even further. And the district attorney today said that they're happy with the charges currently. So we'll see. But it sounds like he will most likely be spending the rest of his life in prison.
You mentioned that Shakur's sister was there at the trial yesterday. Has his family said anything yet about the verdict?
Yes, they did release a statement saying that they were elated and relieved by the verdict. And then they just like thanked the jury, you know, for fulfilling their duty. And then they also just expressed their appreciation for their family and friends, as well as like the court marshals that, because they were there throughout the entire trial and had a lot of help from marshals and advocates.
Jessica Hill is a Las Vegas reporter for the Associated Press. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Last year, President Trump signed an executive order making it easier to mine so-called critical minerals as a way to, quote, create jobs, fuel prosperity, and significantly reduce our reliance on foreign nations. One of those critical minerals is coal. After powering the U.S. through the Industrial Revolution, coal has long since given way to cleaner and cheaper energy sources. But President Trump is pushing for a coal comeback, which could have huge implications for the Navajo Nation. For the Mount West News Bureau, in the first of a three-part series, Gabriel Pietrazio explores the tribe's complicated history with a controversial fossil fuel.
For decades, deafening noise enveloped the Navajo community of Black Mesa. Those thunderous sounds from excavator cranes scraping topsoil to reach dark band seams of coal have since been silenced.
During the time I was a child, it was like that. We were so happy when the Peabody left. And I realized that one day I got up with no noise. The belt line's not there no more. It was so peaceful.
Fewer than 500 Navajos call Black Mesa home today, including lifelong resident Lily Johnson. This snowy swath of rolling hill country also became home to a pair of once booming coal strip mines. Local Navajo leaders in nearby Kayenta agreed to lease tens of thousands of acres to the Peabody Western Coal Company back in the 60s. So did the neighboring Hopis.
They had no idea of what they were getting themselves into when these big drag lines appeared. By that time, it was too late, and the dozers were just knocking down trees.
Today, Black Mesa is basically barren. Sam Yazzie thinks Peabody hasn't done enough to restore the environment since the Black Mesa mine shuttered in 2005, followed by the Kayenta mine closure in 2019.
They're just fulfilling the contract. Nothing more.
Born and raised in Black Mesa, Yazzie actually worked for Peabody. So too did his dad.
Here, we grew up around blasting and herding sheep and taking care of livestock.
But that tradition of raising animals is slowly dying off. Johnson owns a couple dozen Navajo Churro sheep and must adhere to Peabody's strict grazing rules.
If they see livestock, they said they can haul it away. It feels like they have all the rights, even over the Navajo Nation.
Yazzie accuses Peabody of receding reclaimed mine areas with the wrong type of vegetation.
The runoff, the water, whenever it rains and whenever there's snow, it just makes ditches and, you know, and they're not actively going back to fixing all of them. So it's just a shoddy job.
Peabody stands by its work, pointing KJZZ to an award from the Interior Department's very office overseeing the company's progress, but would not address the allegations raised by Black Mesa residents.
Probably did one of the most scaring type job. I was a core driller.
Alex Osef, who is Dene and president of his local miners union, was a Peabody employee for nearly four decades. Now he's the benefits counselor for Arizona's sole Black Lung Clinic, which is helping more than 300 coal miners in the Four Corners.
We're starting to show cases in New Mexico again.
He blames a mine now owned by the Navajo Transitional Energy Company.
I'm starting to see miners show up on our doorstep.
As for Kayenta town manager Jarvis Williams, he's proud of what Peabody did.
I'm a coal miner's kid. My kids are coal miner's kids. it'll be felt for at least a couple more generations, and really up to us to not allow that pride to fall to the wayside.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio, reporting from Black Mesa.
The dishes someone grows up with can tell stories about what a family has gone through. After the U.S. government took more than 2 million acres away from the Moapa Band of Paiutes, the tribe lost their farmlands and some of the traditional meals they ate on a regular basis. A Moapa Band of Paiutes elder remembers some of the meals he grew up eating when the tribe was still living on just 1,000 acres. KNPR's Jimmy Romo talks to that tribal elder about those meals.
When Leland Swain got hungry as a kid growing up on the Moapa River Indian Reservation, there were only a couple of things that he could prepare. He'd often place a pot on the stove, add some water, onion, salt, pepper, and the main ingredient.
A lot of beans.
Born in 1948, Swain was part of what he calls the new generation on the reservation, a generation which began after his tribe gained federal recognition in 1942. Before that, the tribe lived on land the U.S. government allotted the Moapa Paiutes in the early 1870s. By 1875, Congress reduced that allotment to only 1,000 acres after pressure from non-native settlers. By then, the tribe no longer had enough land to farm food from maize, beans, and squash. When the tribe lost its land, some traditional dishes also began to fade because they lacked traditional ingredients. It was a tough life, he says.
We hunted and gathered pine nuts.
Over his lifetime, the reservation saw many changes, including the first grocery store tribal members had access to. But that doesn't mean traditional practices stopped. Moapa Paiutes still hunt and gather and make dishes they grew up with to hold on to a tradition. For Swain, that includes recipes from his grandmother, Topsy Chapel Swain. When Swain was growing up on the reservation, there were no refrigerators. People cooked meals fresh every time they wanted to eat. That's why beans were such a staple. As he remembers, they were cooked with onions and garlic, with some salt and pepper for seasoning.
On any given weekend, you go through our valley out there, and that's all you could whip on the weekend was the beans on the pot.
Those pots of beans were often accompanied by native breads. One of those breads, Swain says, is what youth Southern Paiute call karate bread. Roughly 10 inches in diameter and 2 inches thick, it was baked in the hot ashes of a fire or in the oven.
Grandma used to cook it, especially when we got to the mountains to pick our pine nuts or whatever and go deer hunting. She'd put it under the coals on a rock so it wouldn't get all dirty. She'd take it out, pull it out of the hot coals, and turn it on her hand and give it a chop in the middle and pull it over.
Picking pine nuts was one of Swain's favorite gathering activities. One of his favorite dishes was pine nut soup, ground pine nuts cooked in water. He also enjoyed harvesting nearby mesquite trees. The beans would be ground into a flour for bread with a cinnamon and roasted hazelnut flavor.
And that was a treat for the young people because it had that sweet, sweet taste.
They used the pods and flowers for tea. The same goes for the creosote bush. And while not native to the land, drought-tolerant goji berry bushes left by the Chinese immigrants who built the railroad there are found near the Moapa River Indian Reservation as well.
We lived a simple life back then.
Although Swain's family had access to a grocery store once or twice a month, storing raw meat wasn't possible. That meant hunting cottontails, jackrabbits, and deer during the hunting season. As Swain remembers, summer was the worst time to eat rabbit because of its gamey flavor. But in the colder months, rabbit made a good stew with a hearty broth. It would include beans, potatoes, carrots, onions, and greens. Between September and October, he says, it was time to hunt deer and time for deer stew. Without refrigerators, they removed the red meat from the carcass, dried it on racks to make jerky, and stored it for the summer.
We were always sneaking and getting the jerky as kids.
Beyond tradition, food connects communities. Swain still goes to luncheons on the Moapa River Indian Reservation for seniors' monthly birthday celebrations. At those potluck-style feasts, there is often a stew, beans, and native bread, foods that take him back to his grandmother's cooking. Jimmy Romo, KNPR News.
According to CDC data from 2022, nearly 14% of Nevada adults have a mobility disability. That group includes Sam Schmidt, a former IndyCar racer who lives in Las Vegas. Schmidt had a promising career ahead of him, when on January 6, 2000, he got into a life-changing accident at the Walt Disney World Speedway, damaging his spinal cord and paralyzing him from the shoulders down. Since then, he's dedicated his time to physical recovery, disability advocacy, and growing his Driven Neuro program. That's an organization founded by Schmidt and primarily located in downtown Las Vegas. It provides medical and mental health care, adaptive fitness programs, and rehabilitation services to people with spinal cord and neurological conditions. His time since the accident has also, more recently, been spent writing an autobiography, which Divergent Books released earlier this year, detailing his life before and after the crash. KNPR producer Ann Davis sat down with Schmidt to discuss his debut book and what life on the other side of a life-changing injury looks like 26 years on.
Sam, thanks so much for joining me.
Happy to be here.
I want to start by asking you about what was obviously the most dramatic part of your memoir, which was your crash and then the aftermath. Take me through what it was like to wake up after the accident.
I can identify several, you know, blessings or silver lining moments that were in the book, and that was one of them, is that I was knocked unconscious, not breathing, for about 4 or 5 minutes, and they resuscitated me, got in the helicopter, got me to trauma. My dad was there at the practice in Orlando, and he was making all the immediate decisions, and my wife grabbed the six-month-old and took a red eye back and was there at 6 a.m. the next morning. So don't remember, but I've heard it was pretty ugly.
I actually do want to talk about your dad because, like you mentioned, he was also involved in a life-changing racing accident that left him badly injured, paralyzed, you know, struggling with his own mobility. You make special note in the book of how determined he was to get better and do this very grueling physical therapy. How did seeing, you know, your dad's reaction to recovery influence your own attitude towards recovery decades later?
Yeah, our running joke is he's a farm boy from Nebraska, so if you truly wanted him to do something, tell him he wouldn't get it done, and he'll prove you wrong. And so the same thing, they said he wouldn't walk or talk again. It was a little different because it was a brain injury on his, and it paralyzed the right side, and he lost his speech. They said he wouldn't walk or talk again. That was 1974, and although rehabilitation techniques have improved a lot, you know, he did 2 years of outpatient therapy, 5 days a week, 2 hours a day, and it was just, you know, really, really, really hard work. I went to watch him once, and, you know, seeing him in that much agony and that much effort, you know, to move a finger or to, it just, I couldn't go back and watch as a 10-year-old, you know, and, but it was the blueprint, you know, for when this happened to me. Clearly, he had survived the odds and beat the odds, like, hugely, because he did walk and he did talk again. He just never got used to his right arm, so.
What specific part of your experience inspired you to write this memoir?
There wasn't a lot of information when I got hurt, and we are kind of an extreme case. I mean, aside from getting off the ventilator, I'm still paralyzed from the shoulders down, and I speak to a lot of new injuries. I visit a lot of hospitals. We obviously have the foundation touching, you know, 600, 700, 800 people, unique individuals a year through intensive rehabilitation, but I can't reach everybody, you know, and I can't answer everybody's phone call, you know. So a lot of people thought it was going to be a racing book or a motorsports book, but I really wanted it to be all-inclusive. Yes, there's the racing stuff. There's a lot of tips on what to do right and wrong in a business environment, and also, you know, most importantly, overcoming any challenge. I mean, between my dad's accident, between my mom's 2 rounds of different types of cancers, and this 26 years for me, if I can drive a car now 213 miles an hour, you can't sit there and tell me that anything is impossible, right?
Las Vegas, as you mentioned in the book, has a reputation for having kind of a paltry medical specialist landscape. It can be really hard to access care here for various reasons. After your accident, why did you decide to stay in Vegas instead of moving to a city that was closer to your recovery team, like St. Louis?
Totally. After traveling the world for these 26 years in a wheelchair, I can honestly say the good news, medical may be lacking, but it is the world's most accessible city because of tourism, because of gambling. You know, the RTC, the
the hotel rooms, I mean, the flatness, the weather, everything about this place makes it by far the most accessible city. So why not stay here, number one? Number two, in starting the race team and the foundation, I need to travel a lot. So you can, because of tourism, you can catch a nonstop flight anywhere in the world from here. And I'm talking anywhere. I've been to China. I've been to Europe nonstop. You know, it's just traveling and doing airline transfers in a wheelchair is not ideal, you know, so that helps. But also, you know, I've taken a lot from the city in 30 years, so I want to give a lot back.
What is your relationship with racing and cars now? Do you still engage with the community, watch the sport, stay involved?
Yeah, I mean, my dad had a salvage yard when I was growing up, and I've always been a car guy. I rebuilt a hot rod that I can get in and out of my wheelchairs because I missed it so much. And then, you know, obviously owned an IndyCar team there for the better part of 24 years. And so I'm just a rabid fan, whether I don't own it anymore or not. I'm still going to go to at least, you know, five or six races a year, the ones I want to, not the ones I have to. Formula One, the whole deal. I mean, I've been a racer all my life. It's my passion. And I think I said in the book, you know, racing is my passion, will always be, but driven neuro is my purpose. And so I realized, you know, for a lot of different reasons that I was better to be on this earth and for the future to just focus on driven neuro, growing that because there's just such a dire need.
You talk about in the book what a blessing having good health insurance coverage was, especially in the months following your accident. You added how cognizant you were that other patients you saw come and go at the hospital you stayed at were not so lucky. How did that observation influence sort of the advocacy and the work that you do now with Driven Neuro?
That's what drives it, because believe me, I don't like asking people for money, and I don't like you know, trying to constantly raise money. But the results you can see every day, anytime I've driven, in the faces and the eyes of the families that are involved. The bottom line is you pay really, really exorbitant insurance rates and premiums your entire life. And then ultimately, if there's a major tragedy like this, a stroke, a brain injury, a spinal cord injury, or a number of things, they just basically blankly sell, you're not covered or your insurance has run out. I got 6 months of inpatient rehabilitation, which has allowed me to do what I've done for 26 years, including paying a lot of taxes. So to me, that's the way it should be for the greater good of the economy and our country. Mark my words, I would not move somewhere else. I still think it's the greatest country in the world. But at the same time, they've allowed these for-profit insurance companies to get, you know, literally get away with murder, because now you'd be lucky to get 4 weeks of inpatient rehabilitation, and they just send you home, and most people don't know to beat their chest or advocate for themselves or yell and scream and say, no, I deserve more, I paid for more, I'm staying. That might get you another week or two, but it's just not enough. The family's not ready for you to come home. You're not ready to go back to work. You're not as independent as you can come. And most people just wind up being shut-ins, frankly. It's like a 60% divorce rate in that scenario. And I don't even know what the suicide rate is, but it's not zero. And it's all because the insurance companies just don't give you what you need in those times of tragedy, and they certainly don't support your family enough. So it's just kind of blowing up families. There's 20,000 new spinal cord injuries a year, and if you add the stroke and the brain injury, it's probably closer to 200,000. So this just happens every day, and we can't help everybody, but the goal is to try and give them, bridge that gap, you know, give them some more independence, try and get them back to work, because it's a pretty sad situation.
You write in the book that paralysis is different from many other injuries and that you become effectively a patient for life. And because of that, to continue moving forward in life, you said you need a why. What is your why today in 2026?
It's easy. I mean, first and foremost, my faith in my family, but the driven neuro, seeing again, just devastation of not just the person in the wheelchair, but their entire family. It's, you know, every day I hear of a story, you know, a guy gets paralyzed, his bedroom's upstairs, so it's, you know, everyday household, everyday living, making a decent living, but, you know, just enough to buy a house, you know, and pay the mortgage and pay the car payments. And so with the bedroom upstairs, they just basically put a hospital bed in your living room and say you're on your own. And his wife was a teacher, so she had to do a leave of absence to take care of him, get him up every morning. Son's heading off to college, but nope, we gotta stay home and help dad. And just all, it's a trickle down effect, a domino effect so many people surrounding them and whatever. You know, we got to go out and spend $50,000 plus on a van. I mean, you name it. It is just financially, emotionally, and physically, you know, really demanding, depending on the level of the injury. But, you know, again, keeping them in inpatient and providing proper outpatient funding would make such a difference. And again, mostly males, right? High majority of males that are the breadwinners and, you know, on and on and on. So you take all that away, it's really catastrophic. So we're, you know, we can't, again, address all 200,000 cases a year, but we're going to just keep growing and keep, you know, we have great supporters and incredible trainers and people working at the sites. And I get inspired every time I go there just because I see, I know where somebody was in their walk, and now I see where they are after a month or 2 months or 3 months. Is diametrically different. Their attitude, their independence, their drive and determination, it's hope.
Sam Schmidt is a former IndyCar racer, a Las Vegas-based disability advocate, and the author of the memoir No Finish Line, published by Simon & Schuster earlier this year and available at Booksellers Now. Sam, thank you so much for sharing your story with me.
And if you like to listen to books, my son did the audiobook, which is, I think, really cool full circle as well.